Tonight on Arena, Matt Osman of Suede, bassist turned thriller writer, and as it ends its Netflix run, we appreciate Mad Men once again. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Estranged identical twins, Adam and Brandon Gusgarden, haven't spoken in 15 years. One lives in London, the other in California. When Adam gets a call out of the blue one day and hears that his brother has been shot dead. So begins The Ruins, the debut novel of Matt Osman, Suede bass player. And delighted to have Matt join us on the line this evening. I'm wondering when the idea for writing a thriller first came into your head, Matt. Had it anything to do with a certain band hanging up their guitars in 2003?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I spent a bit of time after that working as a journalist, and I kind of discovered that I loved writing. And I wrote a load of short stories with no real idea what to do with them. And then I did something which I think a lot of young writers, young as in starting out writers, do. I just jammed them all together and pretended it was a novel, a terrible novel. But it kind of got me started, and I suddenly was like, oh, I could actually do this. So yeah, that was part of the start of it, was the band splitting up for a bit.
And certainly, I think some of the things that Adam contemplates during this novel strike me as, you know, associated with coming out of a period of massive fame and then finding yourself perhaps in a different world.
Yeah. I mean, one of the kind of drivers for it was the idea of, you know, what would you do if your life completely changed at 40? You know, I think most people that are pretty set at that time. And one of the things about Suede splitting up is I went from, you know, playing festivals to working in an office in a matter of like 3 or 4 months. So I was kind of intrigued as to whether, you know, your circumstances change you and what it means to be kind of vaguely famous and how it affects you, those kind of things.
And Brandon, who is one of the twins in the book, I guess his experience is something close to that, isn't it? Essentially, he is the rather nasty rock star, it has to be said.
Oh, yeah, he's horrible. he's a terrible, terrible human being and a failed musician. And I'm always fascinated by kind of one-hit wonders and people who are in tribute bands and stuff like that, because that's the experience for most musicians. You know, it's 95% of musicians go through, you know, it's a struggle and it's hard work and there's a lot of failure involved. Even successful bands, you know, it's the failure that's interesting. And I don't know, there was something I think quite cathartic about writing about gigs that no one goes to and everything going wrong and falling out with people.
Did you recognize any of Brandon in yourself or in any other rock star you mightn't care to talk about too much about?
To be honest, I'm not that good a writer. All the characters are me, really. He's just what I would be like if I was a lead singer and slightly more full of myself, you know what I mean? But I don't think it would take much, you know, and Adam, his brother, who's a kind of bookish, stay-at-home nerd, is only 2 or 3 degrees away from me as well. You know what I mean? The paths I didn't take, thankfully.
I think you've also said this is there's a lot of your brother Richard, the television presenter. There's a lot of him in Adam.
Well, I mean, my brother's one of these people who, you know, he used to play these incredible games at home where he'd set up huge football leagues that would go on for 6 weeks, and he'd have books with all the results in. And, you know, anything that was kind of quite immersive and geeky, he was into. But the thing about Richard is he's much, much more social than Adam. You know, Richard's the most social human being who's ever lived.
Adam and Brandon, I guess what happens when and we're not giving anything away because Brandon is dead in the first couple of pages of the novel. He's
exactly,
gone, you know. People
it's
always give
back,
out.
It's fine.
Yeah. But it gives Adam the because they are identical twins. It essentially gives Adam that opportunity to live something of Brandon's life and to go back into that whole idea. How important was that twin aspect of what was driving you when you were writing the novel?
I think, yeah. I mean, I wanted a way of throwing someone into a completely different life. You know, I thought that was an interesting idea. It was something that had happened to me, and I think it tells you quite a lot about yourself. But also, I have twin nieces, and they're just endlessly fascinating. But because they're forced to be different. You know, when you have twins, you have to have... She's the good one and she's the bad one. She's the academic one, so she's the sporty one. And of course, they're incredibly similar, but they almost get forced apart because they're so similar. And that was something I wanted to, you know, at the end of the day, the two characters, they're quite similar. They're all about control. They're all about controlling this little world that they're in charge of. It's a very different world that they found themselves in.
Yeah, because there was an interesting, I read in an interview that you had given where you spoke about this idea about questions around how being loved for what others think you are, how much does that differ from being loved for what you actually are? And I guess, you know, the experience that you had as the rock star in Suede, and suddenly that was gone. Was there a big learning curve there?
Well, I think lockdown's been really interesting for that because you know, I know a lot of musicians and I keep talking to them, and you suddenly realize how reliant you are on kind of constant praise and applause. Everyone's kind of desperate to do gigs again because they're not getting the validation that they get just from the people around them. You know, it takes 10,000 people to validate you rather than two.
Yeah.
It's not a healthy way to be. It's not, Sean.
So obviously then, but Suede has come back. Has it come back in a different way for you then? You know, are you, perhaps you're a decade older, essentially, maybe a little bit more than 2003, obviously 17 years older. But since the band has come back, do you experience it in a different way? Are you able to handle the adulation? Because there has been adulation, let's face it, for the three albums that you've had since getting back together.
Oh, it's been a completely different experience. I mean, the thing is that all I've ever done was Suede. You know what I mean? I mean, me and Brett met at school. You know, we've been in band since we were 16. So I kind of took it for granted. And when we came back, there was a conscious decision that never to let that happen again. And just to realize every day how lucky we are and how privileged we are to do this. It's an incredible way to spend your time. You know, it really is. And I don't know whether I'd be as thankful for it if I hadn't lost it for a little while.
Yeah,
so I hadn't realised that it could be broken.
The other thing was that I wondered about the writing side of things, because yes, you had been involved in journalism, and then Brett Anderson with the two memoirs, Cold Black Mornings and Afternoons with the Blinds Drawn, both of which were hugely successful for him, and indeed he spoke to us about them as well. Had you any idea in your head that you might do a memoir, or was there any point?
Oh God, no. I mean, no one wants to hear from the monkey when the organ grinder's already written his memoirs. I also have an absolutely appalling memory. I mean, Brett's got one of these incredible memories where, you know, he can tell you to the day when a gig was or when something was released. Whereas, you know, for me, there's kind of like 4 or 5 years that I don't really remember much of. I think he's done a fantastic job. Mm. And when I was reading them, especially the first one, because, you know, it's a lot about his childhood, which is in the same place as me, there was loads of things I was kind of like, oh yeah, I remember that. It was quite useful for me.
Did you think of yourself as the monkey rather than, you know, surely you had a little bit of organ grinding to do?
Yeah, but I mean, I think what's happened to the lead singer is more interesting than what's happened to the bass player. I think that's pretty true of every band apart from the Beatles, you know.
So on the psychologist's chair at the moment then, does the poor role, is that a role that the bass player is forced into, do you think, in any way, the monkey, as opposed to the organ grinder?
No, I think most bass players really like it. You know what I mean? I'm one of those people, I like to be kind of like in the middle of things rather than striding on ahead. I quite like being in the background and stuff. I'm not particularly, I could never get up on stage and sing or do anything like that. I even find that the literary events that I've done, I find them genuinely terrifying compared with playing the bass on stage. I'd much rather be playing to 50,000 people at Glastonbury than talking to 200 people, you know, in my own voice.
Sounds like you might be loving lockdown, in fact. Final question to you, Matt Osman, then. Skype conversations play quite an important role in the book. How real do you think they are? Are they a good replacement for real contact?
No, not at all. I think the problem is that they almost are. Someone said something really fascinating, which was, since we've had mobile phones, the world is at an arm's reach distance from us, but no closer. And I think that's what's really frightening about it. I mean, I live on Skype and things like that. When we're touring, I have it open back to my house here. You know, I watch the cats, you know, it's just left open as it is in the book. But you're always disconnected. It's like watching a gig through a mobile phone. You're missing the kind of the sweat and the touch and the realness of it.
Well, I sincerely hope, Matt Osman, that the next time you were in Ireland, you were due to be here, but unfortunately that had to be cancelled, of course. The gig had to be cancelled. So then we'll sit opposite each other and we won't have a Skype call down the line. We'll talk directly to each other.
We'll sweat and touch.
Well, maybe not. Okay. Lovely to speak with you this evening. That's Matt Osman there. Thanks, Matt. Matt speaking to us about his debut novel, The Ruins, which is published by Repeater Books. Tomorrow at noon, a very special event will take place in DCU. It's the virtual graduation of the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health. New graduates more than ever now wanted in our health service. The event will include an address by Arthur on the Heron, Michael D. Higgins, and a recitation of a specially commissioned poem by Paula Meehan. Paula has recorded that poem for us here in Arena. It's called Crossing the Threshold, and she'll introduce it herself.
When Brian McCrae, president of DCU, got in touch with me recently and asked would I offer a poem for the graduation ceremonies there for the School of Nursing, Psychotherapy and Community Health, I was absolutely honoured to be asked. And I thought, you know, in the way of poetry, I would do a few things at the same time. I would honour my own experience as a child with illness and the nurses I met who minded me, and also honour the nurses in our family who are so brave and competent and courageous, and honour the profession, the caring professions who have stepped up in this remarkable time of pandemic and anxiety, and who are out there minding us, minding the people. So I offer this as a citizen and somebody who has family connections into the profession. Crossing the Threshold. When I was a girl, I spent all of 3 months in a fever hospital, a room on my own, far from the city street I lived on. No visitors allowed, but sometimes my mother's face at the observation hatch. She sent in a doll, costumed as a nurse, in a cap and a cape, with a little tin watch pinned to her chest. And that doll became confidant, perched on my locker, a patient witness to my natter and jabber, the long days to endure, and the longer nights when the stars wheeled past my window and I learned their patterned journeys across the heavens, though not what their journeys portended. I called her Nurse Harriet, after the real nurse who came to tuck me in with the last bed pan, with the last dose of tablets, with the last thermometer, with the last taking of the pulse and the chance of a story. What my doll did in the war, what she did in the rising, what she did in the trenches, in the rocket to Mars. She was hero, she was avatar, in her cap and her cape and her little tin watch, perched on the locker, taking my measure through the hot winding nights of sickness and the slow unspooling weeks to wellness. Those whorled fingertips on the thin skin skin at my wrist, that cool hand on my head. I fancy I can hear my own blood thrumming through my veins. I must have been lonely. I must have been frightened. It comes back so clearly, this covered spring wheeling into the summer of 2020. My nieces are nurses, their beautiful faces marked and welted by masks and visors, their word purses full of medical phrases from the Latin end of the dictionary. The matter of factness of their going out to night shift or day shift is to me the entirely miraculous. When I ask what they'd say to you of their lives now, this. How unnatural to say goodbye through Windows, FaceTime, Zoom, the machines ticking out their cycles. How we find new ways to hold and be held. How we deepen in mercy and in kindness. And this is routine. All this is normal. They step over the threshold, outer to inner, inner to outer. They ward off the darkness. They are bringers of light to this world, its dazzling confusions, its crystal certainties. They open the curtains wide to the bright star of morning after a long night. Between one breath and the next, on a blackbird still praising the earth in her turning.
Paula Meehan there reading Crossing the Threshold, a poem commissioned by the DCU for the virtual graduation tomorrow of the students of nursing, psychotherapy and community health. Congratulations and thanks to all of you. On June the 9th, Netflix is cutting ties with Mad Men, the advertising drama set in 1960s New York that for many made TV as significant creatively as film. You have 4 days to get reacquainted or watch for the first time this TV series that marked the beginning of the golden age of television. Jen Gannon joins me now to look back at the world of Don Draper and Company. When we talk about this golden age of television, Jen, first of all, Mad Men aired first in 2007. What was happening at that time in terms of TV and the type of TV series we might have been watching?
Yeah, now it was an AMC show, but at that time, HBO were massive because they had shows like Six Feet Under and David Chase's sprawling Sopranos. And that was really what that kind of this heralded this golden age of television. There was all these sentiments around how television could be a prestige media and it could rival film. And, you know, you also had The Wire coming through as well. So these were these big, important shows that, you know, had the time and space to tell long drawn out stories and proper characterization. And I think Mad Men was one of those shows like that was dominated, had such a dominant presence at that time that changed the face of TV in a way.
To understand the series at all, you have to really think about the central character here, Don Draper. How do you describe him?
Well, I would say, he's, you know, the maverick, magnetic man of advertising, and he woos his clients like as many women, but he's hard drinking, hard living, he's completely self-destructive alpha male, and he has this yearning desire for freedom, but he also has this big aura of impending doom about him. He is the anti-hero, you know, and he looms large, and he's, the whole show is him trying to get some balance in his ever-changing life, but sometimes I feel that, you know, Don himself, he's slowly coming apart the seams like throughout the whole narrative of the series itself. But I think for me, he only really becomes interesting when he's reflected through his relationships with the women of Mad Men. I think sometimes he can be a bit of a vacant archetype, and the women are a lot more interesting to me than him.
The importance of the female characters, I think, is well recognised within the series, and that changed and grew, I think, as the series progressed. Peggy, played by Elizabeth Moss, how did her character develop as things went along?
Yeah, her journey. So she started out as this timid secretary, and then she became, you know, evolved into this outspoken, talented copywriter. And I think her and Don's relationship, which only centers around work, he recognizes her abilities and he almost kind of acknowledges that she has that talent that may surpass him. And I think that is the most successful and fulfilling relationship with a woman that he has in the entire series, because it's not around anything to do with sex or romance. It's just to do with the work. And I think their relationship is fascinating as it goes on.
Yeah, I have a clip here which actually typifies that work relationship. Elizabeth Moss as Peggy, John Hamm, of course, as Don, and they're talking about the ownership of ideas.
You gave me 20 ideas, and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we gonna shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for. You're young. You will get your recognition. And honestly, it is absolutely ridiculous to be 2 years into your career and counting your ideas. Everything to you is an opportunity. And you should be thanking me every morning when you wake up, along with Jesus, for giving you another day.
John Hamm as Don Draper, Elizabeth Moss as Peggy there in a scene from Mad Men. Jen Gannon speaking to us about the series this evening. It's finishing up on Netflix, in fact, on Tuesday next, June the 9th. It's great. There's great equality of argument between the two of them there. And as you say, Jen, it avoids all of the other female characters often are subject to a lot of objectification, none more so than Joan, played by Christina Hendricks.
Yeah, now she is the completely objectified office manager, and she has this real command and presence, but she has no agency almost within the business or even in her own personal life. And I think we see her as an almost Marilyn Monroe figure. She's always viewed through the male gaze, and she's constantly being offered up as the sensual treat by men to other men. But she is, you know, the alpha of most of her entanglements. And I think her story, like Peggy's, it's about gaining control and independence. And she, you know, moves from being an office manager who's keeping the secretaries in check in Sterling Cooper to becoming a partner at the ad firm, and then she eventually ends up running her own film production company. And I think her and Peggy's stories are about overcoming that patriarchal entitlement and those redundant stereotypes. And for me, I think Peggy and Joan are the twin heroes of the series, because they're blazing a trail and they're not like succumbing to self-destruction like all the other men around them within the series.
Well, let's listen to Christina Hendricks then as Joan, and she's fighting back here against the illustrators. They've put a sexist picture of her up in the office, and you'll also hear the voice of Richard Sommer here, who plays the character of Harry Crane.
Who did that?
Did what?
That pornographic drawing. It's a very brave person that does something anonymously.
It's a very brave person who does that. It's still illegal in many states, you know.
I can't wait until next year when all of you are in Vietnam. You will be pining for the day when someone was trying to make your life easier. And when you're over there and you're in the jungle and they're shooting at you, remember you're not dying for me because I never liked you.
Christina Hendricks there as Joan in a scene from Mad Men. Yeah, she is the alpha in that scene, despite the fact that they're trying to tear her down, Jen Gannon.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Joan. She is in control, and she's the one that's moving all the chess pieces, and that's how she operates. And I think there is even a conversation afterwards between her and Peggy, and it's really interesting because Peggy jumps to her defence and she's like, I don't want you to do that because now I look like a crybaby, kind of. And it's a really interesting discussion between the two of them. And that's the thing about Mad Men. It's full of these subtle moments that you get where they're small moments, but then their significance grow later on as you're watching it or as you see the series progress.
Well, you see, you talked there about the strength of the Peggy and Joan characters. What about the character of Betty, as played by January Jones here? She really had to play the 1950s housewife, the quiet one in the corner type of thing.
she was kind of representing that image of femininity from the 1950s that was slowly falling away within the 60s. And I think, you know, she's a much maligned character, but I actually think she's so good, as in that she typified that supporting housewife and that struggle. And she had all these subterranean demons that, you know, she wasn't comfortable enough to, you know, confront. And her story is like kind of the story of that suppression of those nameless, faceless wives that were always standing in the background. And I think, you know, she actually is really important to the character of Dawn as well. Just their relationship as well is of somebody trying to figure herself out as much as Dawn is.
This is a series set in the 1960s for the most part. So we're talking about a very turbulent time in American history, and many of the issues that are happening today in the United States were even more prevalent and relevant back then. How does the series handle ideas around racism?
Yeah, no, I mean, it does tackle, like, not only does it tackle sexism, but there is the whole issue of race, and the civil rights movement is in the background. And I think they have the two black secretaries in Sterling Cooper are Dawn and Shirley, and they face outright racism and daily microaggressions within the office. And they have this running joke between themselves where they call each other the other one's name because they say that the white staff don't notice the difference between them. And then there's this whole amazing episode where you see this unconscious bias unearthed within Peggy, and she's finding herself wondering if she should leave her handbag with Dawn, who's sleeping over in her apartment because there's riots downtown and she can't get home. And it, yet again, it's such a small moment that contains these multitudes, and that's the hallmark of the show, where they have these minor moments that become more significant.
And there's also an interesting episode where it's Pete and Harry, the two characters, arguing about the death of Martin Luther King, and how extraordinary when you hear it, given some of the things that we heard stated from the American president earlier today. When you listen to this clip, what they're trying to do with the death of Martin Luther King, seeing it as some kind of opportunity, perhaps.
I don't know. It's enough of this crap already. All these special broadcasts preempting the primetime schedule. Bewitched, Merv, Dean Martin. You know they might cancel the Stanley Cup?
How dare you? This cannot be made good. It's shameful. It's a shameful, shameful day!
Don't you scream at me. You don't think I'm upset about that man being shot?
Only because it's costing you, you pig!
It's costing all of us! And when's it gonna stop? No one will be happy till they turn the most beautiful city in the world into a shithole!
Gentlemen, stop it! Stop it this minute!
In a second, Bert. Did you know we were in the presence of a bona fide racist?
That's the latest thing, isn't it? Everybody's a racist!
Gentlemen! I urge you to shake hands in the spirit of erasing these remarks.
I'm sorry. I suppose that my comments were inappropriate. I mistook this for a work day.
Don't worry. I'm sure you can make your money back on some movie of the week next fall about the death of a great man.
That is not what I meant.
Let me put this in terms you'll understand. That man had a wife and four children.
And that's Vincent Kartheiser there playing the character of Pete, and Richard Sommer as Harry, arguing over the death of Martin Luther King. Very difficult time for them to portray. Did they manage to get that balance between an entertaining show that was dealing with the office politics, if you like, and the bigger societal picture, do you think, Jen?
Definitely. And like, it is the backdrop of that chaos and unrest of the 1960s. You have civil rights, the women's movement, Vietnam, you know, idealism and radical politics. And they frame the show perfectly. I mean, it's a show really about massive upheaval and change. And I think, you know, they span the entire 60s, and it just gives it this different dimension. It makes it more than just a tale of one man who's a compulsive philanderer and a mystery man. And it's more about a meditation on how modern America actually came into being, which is fascinating. It's so interesting.
I want to finish up, Jen, with the famous carousel scene, you know, Don making his Kodak pitch. But before I do that, because I think if you tell us how you, in lots of ways, you think the series, and Don Draper in particular, it's all about duplicity.
It is. And I think, you know, that is the main idea of Mad Men. It's not just about the duplicity of Don Draper's life, but also the duplicity of everyone around him. They give this clean, acceptable presentation of themselves to the world, and then the ugly truth is churning away in the background behind closed doors. And, you know, this show is about selling an idea of themselves. And like, even America at that time was trying to sell the outdated notion of the American dream, where you were seeing the reality in the background was sending their kids off to Vietnam and the unrest of civil rights. And that is what it's about. It's about that double life that we're all leading.
So as Don is, we'll hear him clicking through photographs here and making the pitch for the Kodak account. What are we seeing as he's making this speech?
We're seeing all the memories of, you know, him and his wife and his children. So it's all their, you know, time together, holiday photos and birthdays and anniversaries and parties. And it's just really there to get their emotions stirred.
Yeah, but we know that his family life has been far from perfect.
Falling apart. Yeah.
Okay. So that's Jen Gannon speaking to us there about Mad Men. And let's finish with John Hamm as Don Draper trying to get the Kodak account.
Teddy told me that in Greek, nostalgia literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards. Forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels, round and around, and back home again. To a place where we know we are loved.
John Hamm as Don Draper in that famous scene from Mad Men. Jen Gannon talking to us about the series, which finishes on Netflix on Tuesday next, June the 9th. So you have the whole weekend to binge on all 7 series. And so two album reviews on this Friday evening. Without doubt, the one that's going to make the biggest splash worldwide, as much for its politics as for its music, comes from Run the Jewels, a hip-hop super duo of rapper-producer LP and rapper Killer Mike, whose emotional speech in Atlanta earlier this week went viral. Fourth album from Run the Jewels is called RTJ4. After that, we go to Australia and Rolling Blackout's Coastal Fever, a band who established a worldwide fan base with their 2018 debut. The follow-up is called Sideways to New Italy. And finally, Westerman, stage name of 26-year-old Londoner Will Westerman, whose debut album, Your Hero Is Not Dead, is out today as well. Eamon Sweeney and Kellyanne Byrne have been listening, and I think they're both pretty much blown away by our first artist tonight. I think it'd be an understatement to say that. Before we play the track, I should tell you, look, the album has real hard-hitting commentary, equally acerbic language throughout. Not for the faint-hearted, so be aware of that, particularly with the first album, RTJ4. We'll start with a clean version, in fact, of the single from the album. Features Pharrell Williams as Zach Della Rocha of Rage Against the Machine fame. The track is called Just. And I told you once before that you should kill your master. Now that's the line that's probably gonna get my ass up. Master of these politics, you swear that you got options. Master of opinion, cause you vote with the white collar. The 13th Amendment says that slavery's a problem. Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar. Get it? Look at all these slave masters posing on your dollar line there from Just. That's J-U dollar sign T. The title of the song from Run the Jewels and their fourth album, RTJ4. You also heard Pharrell Williams and Zach De La Rocha in collaborating in that particular song. Eamon Sweeney, when we talk about Run the Jewels, who exactly are we speaking about?
We're talking about Killer Mike, who kind of rose to prominence via kind of a rap collective associated with Outkast. In Atlanta, and a wisecracking New Yorker, a rapper and producer called ELP. They both respectively had, you know, fantastically successful and very prolific careers. But Run the Jewels, one of these things that started as a side project, in almost in the same way that kind of Gorillaz bizarrely became internationally bigger than Blur, now Run the Jewels are the act that headline festivals, that have become one of the biggest rap acts in the world. And what so striking about this, their fourth album, it's got the energy and the vitality and the ambition of a debut album from two veterans, relatively speaking, and I think, in their mid-40s, really coming into their own.
And I think Kellyanne Byrne, the other thing that is quite extraordinary about this album is how they have hit the nail on the head. Released this week, I think the release was pulled back maybe a few days earlier, maybe a couple of days earlier than it was due, but they are speaking about what's happening in America right now.
That's exactly it. So they released it 2 days early in the wake of George Floyd's death. And it's like they predicted exactly what was going to happen before it did. And I guess because, you know, they generally sing about police brutality, you know, racial inequality. That's on all Run the Jewels records. But I feel like it's most prominent on this one. And I feel like this record is really going to hit home with a lot of people. It's going to go down in history as one of the great protest records in the manner that What's Going On did with Marvin Gaye, Inner Visions by Stevie Wonder. It's just an incredible album. And like I say, it's like they predicted everything before it happened. I mean, there's one song where Killer Mike actually says in the lyrics.
Yeah, well, actually, don't say what he don't. Evening, yeah, don't say what he says, because I have that exact clip.
Oh, you have it. Okay, okay.
And
okay,
I want us to hear him saying it. Walking in the Snow is what you're talking about, and he's referring here to the 2014 death of Eric Garner, and we've just isolated that little section which has a line in it that you won't believe in terms of what, if you've been watching the news from America, what we've been hearing all this week.
From the ages 1 to 4, around the age of 5, you shipped away for your body to be stored. They promise education, but really they give you tests and scores. And they predict in prison population by who's scoring the lowest. And usually the lowest scores, the poorest, and they look like me. And every day on the evening news, they feed your fear for free. And you so numb, you watch the cops choke out a man like me. Until my voice goes from a shriek to whisper, I can't breathe. And you sit there in house on couch and watch.
That's the line. Until my voice goes into it and whispers, I can't breathe. It's extraordinary to think that, now they're referring back to 2014. It's extraordinary that it's so relevant right now, Kellyanne.
It really is. And as you mentioned earlier, that beautiful speech that Killer Mike gave after George Floyd died. I mean, he's the son of a police officer. Mm. And the speech was full of compassion, understanding. He's very intelligent, and they both are, and that's what comes across on the record. I think Eamon mentioned there, you know, they got together when they were a little bit older, so they've been around the block, they understand things, and that's the magic of Run the Jewels, I think, is that they get their message across in an articulate and intelligent way.
Yeah, because there's an absent. I think I'm quoting you when I say this, Kellyanne. You talked about it's clear and honest, never self-righteous or aggressive. And let's listen to just a little clip of Killer Mike in that speech. As you say, it was a press conference from the Atlanta mayor. He refers to the fact that his father was an Atlanta police officer. He refers to his cousins being members of the police force as well. But later on, he puts it up to people. If they really want to make a difference, this is what you got to do.
Because I'm mad, I don't have any good advice. But what I can tell you is that if you sit in your homes tonight, instead of burning your home to the ground, you will have time to properly plot, plan, strategize, and organize and mobilize in an effective way. And two of the most effective ways is first taking your butt to the computer and making sure you fill out your census so that people know who you are and where you are. The next thing is making sure you exercise your political bully power and going to local elections and beating up the politicians that you don't like. You got a prosecutor sent your partner to jail and you know it was bullshit. Put a new prosecutor in there. Now's your election to do it. You want a different senator that's more progressive that promotes marijuana through? Now is the time to do that. But it is not time to burn down your own home.
There you go, Killer Mike, and that extraordinary speech that he made at the press conference of the mayor of Atlanta earlier this week. Go do yourself a favour and go and listen to the full 8 minutes of his speech. You'll find it just by putting in Killer Mike and Atlanta speech. It'll come up. Eamon, does he manage to keep the political aspect of the album there without losing musical entertainment? Because we are reviewing an album, not a political treatise.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. Well, for over the 11 tracks and 39 minutes, what I find, you know, let's put the politics aside for a second, how crisp the beats are, how much energy there is between them. Killer Mike is that kind of Southern Atlantic, kind of got this booming preacher-like voice, and then you get the kind of the wisecracking New Yorker ELP as his foil. This, I think, just works magnificently, and they've done very few interviews for this, but they did tell the New York Times that they said kind of our sound on this record. If you can imagine, it's freezing cold in New York, and you go into Cats Deli, which was immortalized, of course, in when Harry met Sally. You get a pastrami sandwich, and you're on the way out in the freezing cold air, and suddenly somebody punches you right in the face. So. It does feel like kind of like on an entertainment level, you know, kind of like it is just a great hip hop album, you know, harking back to the golden age of political commentary in hip hop, and when Chuck D of Public Enemy, of course, famously said that hip hop was the Black CNN.
Yeah.
And then I think really kind of in the noughties, then kind of it became more about bling and, you know, kind of this kind of macho bravado, and it became kind of very, you know, diluted, you know, right, by the American dream stroke nightmare. And this really feels like reconnecting with hip hop at such an important juncture in American history.
I just want to play a little bit of Pulling the Pin, which features Mavis Staples and Joss Omme, which you both picked out as a standout track as well. Let's listen to that.
You will not travel towards the light if they're in charge of your departure. You think the universe forgot us the way the cursed pitch their product. So our spirit's not a fire that can't be snuffed to turn to dollars. Or the expanse across all space can't be contained in one small dollop. Now I see that it's the same moment in history back to haunt us. And here we are again. Hello, boy. Long time watcher, first time calling it. Every cage built needs an occupant. Got a deadbolt, see you lock it in. Had a good run, but they stopping it. Wanna walk man to the coffin lid. Get your heart out, fiction.
All right, I'm going to have to take it out before Mavis makes her entrance from Pulling the Pin there. There are so many great collaborations on this album, but let's finish up by your overall judgment of the album, Kellyanne and Stars, please.
5 out of 5. I'd give it all the stars in the universe if I could.
Yeah. And is that for the music as much for the politics as it is for the politics?
Absolutely. No, as Eamon said there, I feel it's their funkiest record. Mm. So, yeah, absolutely. For all of those things, for the message, for the music, for the guest appearances, 5 out of 5.
All right. And what are you saying, Eamon?
Well, usually I'm very reluctant to say that an album is an instant classic, but this undeniably is. And I have to echo Kellyanne with 5 stars.
All right, double 5 stars there for RTJ4, and clearly Kellyanne's very happy about that at home this evening. Right, let's move on then to Rolling Blackout's Coastal Fever, who are a 5-piece band with a very long name. They come from Melbourne in Australia. Their debut album, Hope Dance, came in 2018, immediate critical acclaim and commercial success, probably more than they expected. Tell me a little bit about this, a quintet, but mostly guitars involved here, Kellyanne.
Yeah, so they're Melbourne-based, a 5-piece band, and 3 of the members play guitar and also sing: Frank Heaney, Tom Russo, Joe White, and then you've got Joe Russo on bass, or Marcel Tussie on drums. And as you mentioned there, they brought out an album about 2 years ago called Hope Downs, which just, I think, everybody fell in love with. And they were on the road touring extensively for 2 years and then returned back to Australia. And this is where Sideways to New Italy was born. So I think a lot of the album is about their time on the road.
Yeah, and New Italy is a town.
A little bit, yeah.
New Italy is a town. New Italy is a town in Australia.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a town in Australia. Marcel Tussie is from there. So he grew up there. It's a town where, like, a lot of Venetian immigrants emigrated in the 1800s. Yeah.
Okay, we'll listen to a track. We'll listen to a track from Rolling Blackouts, and this is called Falling Thunder. Falling Thunder there, one of the tracks on the album Sideways to New Italy from Rolling Blackout's Coastal Fever. Now, relentlessly happy was how I thought I should feel at the end of these 10 tracks. It's jangly, it's sunny, but it doesn't change over the 10 tracks much, Eamon, does it?
No, I suppose it is more of the same. And if we are going to be harsh on them, or be like a fickle indie fan to kind of berate a band for deviation, either, you know, you kind of, it's catch 22. Like, if you deviate from the kind of the classic sounds that, you know, you made your mark with, people don't like it. And then if you do kind of like more of the same, you know, people can grumble too. But I think
In contrast to Hope Dance, the riffs are a little bit meatier. There's a bit more of a kind of a bittersweet kind of feeling. There is that kind of like themes of home and immigration there that Kellyanne just mentioned. And incidentally, they do have Italian heritage. But when I interviewed them a couple of years ago, they actually said that, oh, all five of us also have Irish roots, as you'd kind of like, not that surprising there, being from Melbourne.
Yeah.
But I find it an immensely enjoyable record, a perfect sunny kind of sun-kissed record. Would have been perfect for last weekend. I'm not too sure about this weekend, judging by the weather so far, but I think it's a brilliant record.
The album is sideways to New Italy, not sideways to Newcastle West, which they'll have to do for their next Irish one, obviously. Kellyanne, energetic, infectious, guitar-driven tracks is what you're saying. You were uplifted by it all.
Yeah, I was really uplifted by it. And actually this morning I put it on first thing, having listened a good few times during the week. And it just instantly put me in a good mood. I feel like they have that thing of, you know how the Beach Boys were able to sing about melancholy subjects, but the melodies were so uplifting. And I feel like Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever, I'm always afraid of messing it up. I feel like they have that thing that the Beach Boys did, that they can, you know, they can talk about these things of like being lonely and still sounding upbeat.
Right, so upbeat even if they're downbeat in their emotions. Stars from you, Kellyanne.
Yeah.
How many stars?
4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. Eamon?
4 out of 5.
Mm-hmm. I will match that 4 out of 5.
Oh, we're in great accord so far. Let us move on to album number 3. I'm just going to let a little bit of this play and then you can have a go at each other when it's over. The artist is Westerman and the album is called Your Hero Is Not Dead, and I'm going to play a track called The Line.
I open up, sit with the issue in the sun with an ice cream in my hand. Am I looking too closely? Am I taking it?
And that's a track called The Line from Westerman's album Your Hero Is Not Dead. Fey, weedy, twee, bloodless, dull, lifeless, unfocused, millennial ramblings. Those are all quotes from you, Eamon Sweeney.
Yes, I just cannot get into this. And maybe it's the juxtaposition of, you know, listening to two of the best records of the year that I was kind of, when I wrote those notes, I was maybe slightly harsh, but I've tried to give it a chance. And the more I listen to it, it's just it's vague, it's wish-washy. The tunes are not there. The line there, that snippet that you just played, that's by far the strongest track.
Okay.
The rest of it, some of it really is bordering on absolutely awful.
All right, so you've added vague, wish-washy and bordering on almost awful. You listen to the same two other albums, Kellyanne, but your expression here, or your reaction here is totally different.
Totally different. For me, I absolutely loved this. I felt like he echoed Arthur Russell, and I'm a major Arthur Russell fan. So I actually thought this album was stunning. And I thought his voice, it goes from sounding years, way older than what he is, to like almost like a choir boy. I thought there were loads of great tracks on it. It had a vibe of early Peter Gabriel, you know, a little bit of the Blue Nile. I absolutely loved this record.
And how would you, what would you suggest, Eamon? How should he approach listening to it? Clearly he's approaching it in the wrong, or in a different way from you if he's not having, yeah. How should he approach listening to this to get what you're getting?
I don't know. I mean, I'm actually surprised, but look, sure, I suppose if it's not your bag, do you know what I mean? But I from the get-go, the opening track, Drawbridge, it just had me from the very start. But I do think it's got to do with the fact that I love Arthur Russell, and he's quite similar to Arthur Russell.
What are you saying, stars here, Kellyanne?
4.5.
4.5. I think that's to get at Eamon Sweeney. Eamon Sweeney, what are you saying?
Well, we're not on the same page on this one. I'll go 2.5 maybe.
Yeah,
I have to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. Maybe the next time will be a masterpiece and I'll be eating my words.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's Eamon Sweeney and Kellyanne Byrne there speaking to us about our albums this evening. Accord on the first two, but clearly, as you heard, total discord on the final one. That is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched as usual. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Andrew Kane was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I'm off for the week. I'm going to take a little bit of time at home. Won't be travelling more than 20k, but won't that be nice to be able to travel that? So have a good week. Talk to you on the 15th of June. Keshi, he will be in the seat next week, and I'll talk to you then in a week's time.